It's time for Bounded Enthusiasm.
Hi, welcome to the Bounded Enthusiasm podcast. I'm Jonathan Lee, your host, and today I have with me Andy Weir, the author of The Martian, which is a great book about a guy stranded on Mars. We'll get to that in a minute. It is being made into a movie with Matt Damon starring as the main character, Mark Watney, and that is due out this fall. And so I'm happy to have Andy on today just to talk about his book and whatever else he is interested in. So thanks for being here, Andy.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I know from your bio that you were a software engineer for 25 years.
25 years in the industry. I liked it there too. Yeah, when I left, I quit about a year and a half ago to go full-time writing. But it wasn't like a take this job and shove it situation. Mm-hmm. I liked programming computers and I liked the company I worked at. And I liked my coworkers and stuff. It was sort of bittersweet. I was like, okay, well, I'm leaving a job I love to follow a dream I've always had. Yeah.
It seems like it's going pretty well. You've got your first book was a hit, and now it's being made into a movie.
It's like this Vanilla Sky thing. I don't even know. It's just so all of my dreams coming true, and I don't know what I did right.
I mean, I assume when you wrote The Martian, you were still working at your job. How long did it take you to write the book?
All told, I spent about 3 years working on The Martian, on and off. Just I was posting it chapter by chapter to my blog, or to my website, really. It wasn't even a blog. I didn't post, like, innermost thoughts and feelings to it. It was just writing.
Just The Martian.
Yeah, well, no.
Oh, just writing.
But, yeah, lots of things. I had three different serials going on at the same time. Sometimes I'd go months between chapters on The Martian. It was just a hobby.
So it was, like, real time. We don't know what's going on with Mark right now.
Yeah, kind of. Actually, I guess, yeah, it took me longer to write than the amount of time that it takes place during.
I did wonder on that because I know in the book, so for our listeners who have not read the book or aren't familiar with it, you know, Mark Watney is an astronaut on a manned mission with other people to Mars, and they have to leave thinking he's dead. There's an accident, and he gets stranded on Mars at first with no communication whatsoever with NASA or his crew, and he has to figure out how to survive until, one, he can get in contact with NASA, and two, until they can get back to rescue him. So it's a long time that he's going to be there.
Well, yeah, his initial plan for trying to survive is there's the next manned mission to Mars. He was on the third manned mission to Mars, and the fourth manned mission was planned to be 4 years later.
Right.
And in a completely different place on Mars.
So thousands of kilometers away, and he's in a hab that's designed for a month-long mission.
Right. Yeah, 31 sols. A sol is a Martian day, which is 24 hours and 39 minutes. So it's pretty much the same as a day.
So in the book, once eventually Earth finds out that he's alive, he manages to send a message, right? And then now you've got NASA and you've got JPL and you've got all these engineers on Earth trying to figure out a solution to how do we save this one guy on Mars. And in the book, the whole world is interested in this. You've got the Mark Watney time slot on CNN is like the highest rated thing.
The Mark Watney report.
Right. And I was thinking about that. And on the one hand, I was like, yeah, I mean, if we had a manned mission to Mars and someone was stuck there, we would want to see that and we would want to figure out what was going on. And on the other hand, I wondered how many people would go, whoa, that's really interesting. And they post it to Facebook or Twitter. And the next day they would be talking about the Kardashians again.
During the O.J. Simpson trial, there were multiple dedicated TV shows to what happened in the O.J. Simpson trial today. It's like the O.J. report was like a half hour show on court TV.
It's one of those things where some celebrity news takes on this huge importance. And so it's one of those things where I guess it depends on how much Mark Watney becomes a celebrity and how much people go, oh, that's like some sort of science news. And
well, it's a human life and
yeah.
People care about that. Another reference would be during the Apollo 13 crisis. Mm-hmm. I think it was about 6 days from the time they had their initial problem to the time they touched down. It was just constant wall-to-wall news of that, and people out in the streets watching the big screens in Times Square kind of thing, and a huge mass prayer at the Vatican for him. It really captures the public when a person's in trouble.
There is that theory, though, that when you have an individual that's in trouble, it sticks in people's minds a lot more when there's a whole population in trouble, which is unfortunate, but true, right? You need the personal story.
Well, yeah, but usually when a person is in trouble, they are in more immediate trouble than each individual of a population in trouble. So like right now, for instance, Greece is in trouble, right? But that's like they're in danger of having severe economic hardship. If the entire nation of Greece were in danger of all dying, like in the next couple of days, you bet we'd care about that a lot, right?
Now, so going back to the book here, I've heard it compared to MacGyver on Mars. I mean, basically, this guy is figuring out how to survive with duct tape and the little bit of soil that he had, earth soil that he has, that he manages to figure out. And I won't want to give too many spoilers, but he's trying to grow food on Mars.
Yeah, and that's a fair thing to call it, is MacGyver on Mars.
Right.
That's reasonable.
I was wondering, for that, what were your own inspirations for the story? For, you know, well, I guess first, what inspired the idea? But also, how did you come up with the problems he would run into and the solutions he'd had?
Yeah, the idea came about because, well, I'm a space dork, and I always have been my whole life. I've been into manned and unmanned space flight. I'm just really interested in that stuff. And I was sitting around thinking about how to put together a manned Mars mission, just with today's technology. And not for a book or anything, just sitting around speculating, okay, how could we do this? And so I was putting it all together, and I said, like, okay, what if this goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? What if this other thing goes wrong? How do you make sure the crew doesn't die? I mean, any mission plan needs to account for that sort of stuff. And so I was like, well, what if this and this and this went wrong? And I'm like, well, the crew could do this thing, and then they'd survive, and they'd be okay. And I'm the increasingly desperate things that they would have to do to survive, I was like, this sounds like it might make an interesting story. And so I created an unfortunate protagonist and subjected him to all of it. As for how I came up with the problems, space is really dangerous. I mean, space travel, especially a manned mission to Mars, is incredibly dangerous. You know, when you're the writer, to put your astronaut in mortal jeopardy, all you have to do is say, like, this one minor thing broke. And then all of a sudden, their life is in danger, right? It was easy to come up with.
Wait, so you needed to narrow down the potential problems too.
Well, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you assume that you assume this is a well planned, well executed Mars mission that had a problem. You have to assume that it's like, well, they accounted for a lot of the normal problems that they could expect. So it's not like everything is a single point of failure and he's just constantly desperate. It's like, no, okay, they had a contingency plan for what to do if this happens, for what to do if that happens, safety equipment, secondary, tertiary systems, etc. And so we had a lot of that to rely on. Also, I tried to make each problem that he ran into caused by the solution to the previous problem.
Right, right.
So he'd have a problem, so he'd cannibalize some piece of equipment to fix this problem. Well, now the lack of that piece of equipment now causes him a new problem.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He didn't just keep getting unlucky over and over again. It's this cascade failure that, you know.
Right.
Or that's the hope, anyway. That's
right, right.
I tried to make it.
You had Mark as a botanist, right? So a lot of the stuff that he does involving plants and how he's going to grow food comes because he has this expertise on botany. And he's also an engineer, so he's got a lot of just basically his problem solving and figuring out how to do things. But there's a lot of very detailed numbers about things. Like, this is how many calories I need, this is how many calories potatoes will give me, and this is how long I need to do this with the soil or whatever. What I wanted to know was, he's out there, and presumably, he doesn't have Wikipedia with him. For me, I was like, I could go and look up a lot of things. I'm not Mark Watney at all, right? But I rely on Google as my external brain for facts and some statistics and some figures. You know, I can go look up just about anything. But the number of things that I could do just without having a reference is much, much smaller. How realistic do you think it would be for someone to have that level of expertise on any given subject?
Well, considering he's a a botanist and has a master's in botany.
Yes.
Anything related to plant growth and calorie counts and stuff like that, it's reasonable for him to know that. I mean, to know how many calories are in a potato, I bet you most botanists would know that.
Okay.
And how to grow potatoes, I can
yeah, yep.
virtually guarantee they're going to know all about that. As for taking care of your caloric needs, I mean, I know that off the top of my head. Anyone who's ever dieted and counted calories knows that. And also remember, he's not just some guy off the street. He was selected to be, you know, one
right.
of very few astronauts who go to Mars, and then he was heavily trained. So I think his levels of knowledge. Also remember, anything related to the equipment that's
yeah.
present, he's going to know inside and out. Because,
okay.
of course, they train the living crap out of astronauts
right.
on their equipment.
But he's doing some stuff with the equipment that was... Not
right.
not as intended.
Right, but he knows
yeah.
the limits and makeup of the equipment.
Yeah.
And he's an engineer also. He's a
yeah.
mechanical engineer.
The movie's coming out this fall, very soon. We've seen the trailer, which looks great.
October 2nd.
How involved were you in the movie making process?
Mostly my job was to cash the check. They didn't have to involve me, but they chose. I mean, they could have by the contract. Once they have the film rights, they can do
yep.
whatever they want. And they could have just said, see ya. But they chose to involve me, which was cool, especially Drew Goddard, who wrote the screenplay. We talked on the phone a lot as he was writing it. He had a lot of questions. Once he got drafts of the screenplay, he sent them to me for feedback. You know, I gave my feedback, and he made some changes based on feedback and ignored other things, which is fine. It's his screenplay, right? It was cool. Also, I would get questions from Ridley... filtered through. I never spoke to him directly, but filtered through a few layers of indirection. And the questions were highly technical, which was really encouraging, right? It means they really cared a lot about technical accuracy. And so just these really deep, detailed scientific questions. Plus, they had advisors at NASA and JPL, and I'm pretty happy with it. And I can't talk too much about the screenplay itself or Foxhole, you know. Yep. But I can say that, you know, I've read it and I'm very happy with it.
Okay, well, I won't ask you too much more about the movie. Have you gotten to see any more than the trailer for the movie?
No. I haven't seen anything more than you've seen. I mean, I've seen a couple of photos from the set, which
sure.
is cool, that haven't been released. But other than that, no, I haven't seen any of it. They have had some test screenings of it, and they've invited me to them, but like they've always been kind of too far away from where I live for me to get to conveniently, so I haven't seen it yet.
So you'll see it October 2nd with the rest of us?
Yeah, well, I think they're going to show it to me earlier than that.
Yeah.
But,
Yeah, well, I'm definitely looking forward to it. I know a lot of the Geek Dads just love the book. We were talking about it constantly, so we're all excited to see it on the big screen, too.
Oh, yeah, I'm excited.
I think it'd be pretty cool. So now that you've quit your software engineering job and you're doing writing full time, do you want to share anything that you are currently working on, or is it still, you know, under wraps?
No, it's not secret.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on my next book now. It's tentatively titled Zhek, Z-H-E-K. That's a working title. It might change. It's more traditional sci-fi. It's got aliens and faster than light travel and stuff like that.
Okay.
So hope my readers like that too.
Is it going to be more hard science fiction or more, I don't know what other term
soft.
For that is, soft science fiction?
It's definitely softer sci-fi than The Martian.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find anything harder sci-fi than The Martian
right.
other than historical events, right? It's soft sci-fi, but done my own way. Like basically what I did was I needed there to be faster than light travel.
Mm-hmm.
That's critical to the story. And so I'm like, okay, I spent a month coming up with a physics model that enables faster than light travel. And I said, like, here is the thing, like the smallest change I can make to reality such that FTL works.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I figured that out. And then I adjusted things such that it's not in conflict with real world physics. So I think I've got it pretty well set.
What's some of your favorite science fiction?
Well, my dad is a huge sci-fi fan himself and has been his whole life. And so as he grew up, he bought sci-fi books all the time. And so when I was growing up, he had this huge bookshelf just jam-packed full of old sci-fi paperbacks that he'd read when he was a kid. So I had this infinite supply of sci-fi from the 1950s and 60s and early 70s and stuff. So I grew up reading science fiction that was about one generation off from my actual generation. So for me, the authors I grew up reading are Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke. Those are my kind of holy trinity.
Yeah, yeah.
Little later on, Larry Niven and Clifford Simak. Nowadays, I loved Ready Player One by Ernest Klein. It's one of my favorite books ever. And Wool by Hugh Howey, and pretty much anything by Peter Kleins, not to be confused with Ernest Klein. Peter Klein. Good stuff.
So we've also been talking about Armada, which comes out
speaking of Ernest
tomorrow,
Klein,
right? Yeah. Well, it'll be out by the time that the podcast is posted.
Is it tomorrow?
I think it's tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
So okay. I
saw Ernie just a couple of days ago. I was at Comic-Con and there, yeah. And, well, I read Armada months ago because he sent me a review copy. It's one of the cool things.
Yeah.
Being an important writer is I get to do that stuff. I loved it, and I recommend it.
I have read it as well.
There you go.
What I thought was really fun was the fact that, you know, it takes place outside of Portland, where I live in Portland. When he's talking about Beaverton, it's like, I know where that is.
There you go.
I will admit, when you got up just a minute ago, I noticed your game shelf behind you.
Yes.
And I can tell, at least just from glancing, that you appeared also to be a Kickstarter fan.
Most of these are mainstream published games. I'm a big fan of board gaming. I'm definitely a board game geek. There are a few Kickstarter games in there. Most of them were provided by my regular gamer buddies. So my place is sort of where my friends descend for gaming. And so a lot of those, or some of those, belong to my friends. You know, I'm not much of a Kickstarter game kind of guy.
Okay.
But I mean, a lot of the games that I like were Kickstarters.
Right.
But I need, like, someone else has to come and recommend it to me.
Gotcha. You know? So you get them, like, basically after they've been done and...
They've been done
hit,
and vetted.
Hit the stores.
Yeah. There's a pretty rough signal-to-noise ratio on...
Oh, absolutely. I end up writing a lot about Kickstarter board games. So I get to, kind of like the advanced reader copies of books, I get advanced prototypes of games when they're on Kickstarter. And
some of them are just like, it's the people who made them, like, they care only about aesthetic and, like, there's no mechanics at
right,
all.
Right, right, right.
Mechanics are awful or I don't know. But fortunately, there are some gems that come out of Kickstarter and it's great.
Any favorite games currently?
Oh, let's see. That'll shift. Like, if you ask me in a month, I'll have a completely different answers. But one game that really has staying power with me is Power Grid. I really love Power Grid, and I've always loved it. Soul Keen, the Mayan Calendar, I like that one a lot. And also Stone Age. Both of them are good worker placement games. I really enjoyed Splendor.
Okay.
Yeah, more than I thought I would. I really have fun playing it. Oh, and another one of my favorites is Hanabi.
The cooperative game where you don't look at your own cards.
Right. Was that a Kickstarter?
I don't think so. I'm not sure it was.
But I've got a great version of it. I've got it where they're basically Mahjong tiles.
Right. I've seen that one in stores. Yeah. I haven't played that version.
It's so much nicer than the cards because you don't have to hold up your hand all the time.
You right. Just you just set them out.
The tiles in front of you. My friends and I have gotten a 24 once for your listeners. The best possible score is 25. It's a cooperative game. And we got a 24 once. I've never gotten a 25. One of my friends was in a game with her at the 25, but I wasn't there. Maybe that's why they got the 25. They didn't have me screwing things up.
You know, because I play board games so much, I look at things in terms of gaming, too, as far as, oh, look at this guy stuck on Mars. What sort of game could you make out of that? Because he's got resources, and you got to take things apart.
I did put some thought into that. Mm-hmm. What I would do is, instead of making it just one astronaut who's stranded on Mars, I would make it your whole crew
right.
is stranded there. So each one of you plays things. And then each one of your crew members would have some special ability. And then what I would do is I would say, like, okay, here are all these things. Like, okay, the life support system, the integrity of your HAB, the rocket. You have to fix the rocket to leave, and you have to do all these things. And then there could be sandstorms. And then a mechanic I came up with for that would be, there's a deck of cards that are like hazard cards.
Right.
And so most of them are just blank, but some of them are like disaster or whatever hazard, right? And so every round, you add a hazard card to each one of your vital components. At certain times, it'll be time to reveal all the hazard cards and see if anything bad happened to it. And so by repairing it, by doing repairs or maintenance on it, you can remove hazard cards from it in advance. But if it breaks, then you have a serious situation that you need to deal with and expend resources. I put some thought into it, of course.
If you ever do decide to publish a Martian-based board game, well, please let us know.
Well, it's funny because I can't publish one that would be branded to the Martian, but I mean, I could make a game about surviving on Mars, but actually Fox owns the board gaming.
Right,
yeah, the contract. So I wouldn't be able to do it, well, not without their permission.
Right. It would be the Andy Weir Mars-based
Yeah, it'd be like
cooperative game.
On Mars or something like that. But it wouldn't be
the Martian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wouldn't have Matt Damon's face on the box.
Right. And I wouldn't be able to use the names of the characters.
Right. That sounds like a fun story. I mean, I think the cooperative games, what you always have is you need X amount of time to do everything that needs to be done, and you have X minus 3 turns to do it.
Yeah, pretty much. That's how co-op games work.
Right. Well, it looks like that's about all the time we have for today. So is there anything else you want to put in a last-minute plug for before we sign off?
Martian comes out October 2nd. Everyone should go see it.
Awesome. And the movie tie-in paperback, I know, also comes out. So if you want Matt Damon's face on the cover instead of the astronaut in red dust.
Right.
That's also available.
It's the movie tie-in version is basically, it's the movie poster.
The movie poster.
Is the cover.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the podcast, Andy. I enjoyed talking to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
This podcast has been a production of the Geek Dad Podcast Network. If you've enjoyed this content, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geekdad.